Hi, I'm Troy Bronsink, and this is From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. The full episode has two parts. It's a conversation and a guided meditation. What we do is connect you to a variety of contemplative teachers, hearing their story as well as sharing their meditative practice. If you don't have time right now to hear Richard Rohr's story, take a look at the show notes for when the meditation portion begins, and just feel free to skip ahead and come back later to our conversation. We've also learned from our earlier episodes that there's kind of two frames of mind. There's the listening to an interview, and then there's the engaging as a practitioner. For that reason, we've taken out the meditation portions as well and created what we call pocket practices. And the hope is that you'll download those and include them in your daily practices. Today, we're talking with Father Richard Rohr. If you haven't heard of him before, you're probably living under a rock. He's the founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation. He was in Cincinnati for quite a while. We'll actually share some of that story together and also hear from him about the wisdom tradition of the cosmic Christ and the notion of recognizing God in everyone. So you could be doing a million different things right now. Maybe you're pulling down the storm windows or bringing in the old Yule log for the fire. But whatever it is you're doing, take a second now and just take a breath. Notice the space around you and enjoy listening. Hopefully afterwards you'll be able to sit in for the meditation portion. Well, it's a real joy today to be with Father Richard Rohr. I know Richard from the Living School, and you might know him from a number of other things, including the Center for Action and Contemplation, and as an author and contemplative and a friar that lives in New Mexico now. Richard, it's great to be with you.
Very good to be with you. Thank you.
You bet. When we've been doing these podcasts, the discussions have often been at this intersection of contemplative practice and then how that shows up as action in the world. I wanted to start because there's a little bit of your story that connects to the Hive. One neighborhood over from us is Spring Grove, where there was a community there back in the, would it be in the 60s or 70s?
I moved into Winton Place in 1973.
Okay. Around the same time, I heard you share this with us at one point, similar to the time as the Sojourners and Church of the Savior and other things
that
were happening.
All came. I was just with many of those folks this past week. And
with the Red Letter Christian folks? Yeah.
Yes, the Red Letter Christians. Yeah, it was wonderful.
Great. Wow. And so I was interested in, you know, I think over time, what contemplative practice means to us kind of changes. I'd be interested if you'd tell a little bit about that experience in Winton Place and Spring Grove area and what practice looked like to you then and how that compares to your contemplative practice now.
You know, it's funny you'd mentioned Spring Grove. There was a gate on Winton Road, and I'd often walk through that and do spiritual direction and just friendly conversations with people walking among those beautiful tombs, Spring Grove Cemetery, especially in springtime. It was wonderful. Well, certainly my practice and my appreciation of contemplation has changed over the years. In those younger years, to be honest, the community grew so big there in Winton Place, and I was much more an activist than a contemplative, but it was precisely that which drove me out here in 1986 to found a place that would specifically teach contemplative prayer. I think those were very contemplative walks we had in the cemetery on many levels. And I had my early Franciscan novitiate up on Coleraine Avenue on the other side of where you're at right now.
That's right, yeah.
In Northside. And I think that's where I was first introduced as a Franciscan to the entire concept of contemplation.
I think a lot of folks, when we think of a friar or somebody that's part of a spiritual order, we think of their spiritual practices as being filled with all this extra time and schedule and routine and liturgical seasons and that. As you say, like moving to New Mexico was a shift towards really rooting things in practice. What does practice look like for you now? What is your way of practicing the contemplative life?
A not uncommon practice in religious orders is that once you've shown you can live in community, which means you're not antisocial, you can relate to people, you can forgive and relate socially.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes sometimes you're allowed to live in a hermitage in your later years. I'm almost.
I
70.
Love that prequel on that going like, qualifier. Like once it shows you can live with others, then you're allowed to live on your own. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was the universal practice. No one gets to start as a hermit.
Oh, okay.
It's too often not from a good motive.
Okay.
But anyway, I've been living now 17 years here in a little cottage, sort of set apart from the parish and even the center here where I'm at now, which is around the corner. So I'm close to places where I work with people and meet people, but actually I wake up in solitude. Mm-hmm. And that's where I usually make my cup of coffee and light a candle, as I did this morning. And there I first try to center myself. Well, first I try to wake up, to be honest. then I usually have my journal sitting there and a stack of spiritual books, and I never know which one I'm going to open. But it's a combination, almost an hour of reading and silence and journaling. And sometimes it's more one than the other. Mm-hmm. But then I drive around the corner here, 3/10 of a mile, and the center is localized here. And the staff gathers, at least much of the staff. We have almost 40 people on staff here. And we gather at 8:30 for a 20-minute sit of silence together. Okay. Then we read the gospel of the day, and people are sending us every day stacks of prayer intentions. So we read those individually. Everybody reads one, which sort of connects us, not just sort of, it really does. Some of these petitions are so heart-breaking, what people suffer and what people are going through. So it moves us immediately into connection, solidarity with the suffering of the world. And then we go about our work.
I know that the folks at the center aren't all part of religious orders. So this is like somebody to work and they're trying to develop a school or a business or whatever that is, but they start out with this kind of collective intention tied to these other prayer intentions.
That's right. That's right.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
And we feel very blessed that, you know, I think one of the great movements that's happening now is to disconnect contemplation with the idea of celibacy and monastery. Maybe that had to happen in earlier centuries, but obviously we don't want to limit contemplatives to people who have got all those safeguards that we did.
Yep.
The disciplines of silence, no wife, no children. Maybe that had a few advantages, but we found out it had a lot of disadvantages too.
Certainly in my life as a I'm not part of an order, and I still have
these practices.
Yeah, yeah. So we've been at the Hive. There's a lot of interaction interspiritually. So we're with folks from a variety of traditions that have practices, and then for my case, coming from Christian lineage, practices like Lectio Divina or Ignatian prayer practices, and then on to centering prayer and welcoming prayer. These are within the stuff that we practice there, as well as other traditions. How have you seen that change over time in terms of this appreciation of practice as it comes from a variety of different lineages and streams?
Well, you know, it's funny you'd ask that right now. I just left a book discussion group in the right outside my office where we're discussing Barbara Holmes' book, Joy Unspeakable.
Hmm.
And this is just the latest chapter, but she's a Black theologian, very wise in my opinion. And she's pointing out, and I think it's legitimate, that, you know, the Black churches and the Pentecostal churches have their own ways of coming to contemplative silence. I think of my time in Cincinnati, where I was my first 15 years, and the community there in Winton Place was very charismatic at that time. Mm-hmm. And we'd have a huge group of young people singing in tongues, and it would always move towards silence. And the room would just be wrapped in silence for a few minutes. And I think Barbara Holmes, among others, is really making this point that the only way to contemplate can't be too tied to posture or having a quiet room. Those are all wonderful aids. And we've learned a lot from Buddhism in that regard. You know, in the book I just finished writing on the Universal Christ, I pointed out that in most of art, Jesus is pictured with his eyes open, and the Buddha is pictured with his eyes closed, almost universally. And they both have a good message. But I think this eyes open has something to teach us. Because if we can only teach contemplation to people who have the ability and the time and the space to sit still on a mat in a disciplined posture, which I think is wonderful, but most of the world is never going to be contemplative.
Yeah.
And I noticed Jesus never emphasizes posture. So there have to be other ways to come to the silencing of the heart. And the mind. And I called it normally great love and great suffering. So we're going to be trying to integrate that more in our school in the upcoming years. Because a lot of people, frankly, I find they give up because they have a high metabolism. They just, by inclination, especially if they have children or they're young, they just can't sit still twice a day for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we haven't limited it maybe a little too much in that direction.
This summer we did a contemplative small group around Parker Palmer's work, The Courage to Teach.
And
in he talks about bearing the paradoxes. And it's kind of a nod towards non-dualism, though he doesn't get into that language. But there's this point where he says there's this longing for holding both sides of these paradoxes, whether it's like the big idea and the particular, or whether it's the classroom and the student, or whether it's the world and the city, like all these just big paradoxes. Sometimes you just wait while you hold that paradox. And as you're waiting, there's a word for that, and it's called suffering. And
wow.
And it sounds to me like this is some of what you're talking about, that practice is about the ability or capacity to do that kind of waiting, not about just, can you sit still long enough in a hard
place? Yes, yes, that's right. And sometimes grief gets you there. Sometimes a moment of awe, wonder, surrender, whatever gets you to unspeakability is the doorway to contemplation, where words are not adequate or words are not needed. But I think we might have emphasized having to sit absolutely still for 20 minutes, as it were, maybe a little too much. Because I find many other people, if they're told about it, if they're invited into it, come to the contemplative mind to unspeakability in different ways.
So let's play with that unspeakability a little bit. I'm curious about this work you're doing with Cosmic Christ, with Universal Christ, because conversation I had 2 years ago with a yoga teacher, when she would talk about Krishna energy, and she would talk about this notion of breath that's tied to, I think she even used the word omega point, similar to Teilhard, right? There's this kind of
yes.
this connection. And as Joey, who helps produce the show, as we were talking about this, we realized that there's, in a lot of the inner spiritual circles, the word Christ becomes like a, can be a sort of trigger.
At
the same time, inside of a lot of Christian circles, the word Christ can be severely underestimated to be just like Jesus's last name, I've heard you say, right? So, I'm curious if you'd begin to kind of thread together, what is that sort of space for holding pain and awe, that space for that speechlessness, and how is that similar to and resonate with this notion of the cosmic or universal Christ?
Yes, it's what I think Paul means by the mind of Christ. You know, we've emphasized in, if you were raised Christian, having devotion to Christ or believing in Christ. And what we're trying to say is the more important thing is to have the mind of Christ, to believe and trust reality the way Christ did. Now, that isn't so much a belonging system anymore. That's not join my tribe, join my group of fellow Christians. In fact, my most recent definition of a Christian is one who sees Christ in everybody else. And you don't have to call it Christ, but when you see the divine presence in other people, I think you have the mind of Christ. And I have to be honest, I've met Jewish people, I've met Sufi Muslims, I've met Hindus who see the godly presence in other people. They don't call themselves bona fide Christians, nor do they need to, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. As you know, Jesus said, it's not those who say, Lord, Lord, but those who do the will of my Father in heaven. And I think the will of God is that we see the divine presence in everything. Now, that for me is the Christ mystery, that the Christ existed, as Ephesians says, as Colossians says, as the prologue to John's gospel says, the Christ existed from all eternity. So the Christ precedes Jesus by 13.6 billion years, all right? I'm not trying to downplay Jesus, but Jesus is the personification, we believe, if you're Christian, in a moment of time of the mystery of divine presence that has existed since the Big Bang. Now, this is the book I've just finished writing, so I'm sort of too filled with it. That's all I think about anymore.
Right, sure.
It won't come out till next Thanksgiving, but I'm glad you asked about it because, as you said, most Christians, Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, we weren't trained to see the Christ as much more than his last name, as you said, which almost entirely misses the point. In fact, it entirely misses the point.
Not even short say almost. Yeah, it just
Yeah. And it's nobody's fault. It's just I don't think consciousness was ready to see this huge picture, this universal picture we're talking about. Although some of the early Eastern fathers already had this rather clear. And whoever wrote Ephesians and Colossians and the prologue to John's gospel, they already saw the Christ in cosmic terms. But once we identified with empire, we didn't want a universal religion. We called ourselves Catholic, which means universal, but we wanted an imperial religion. And so we pretty much concentrated on Jesus the last 2,000 years, not very well all the time. But we lost the notion of the universal Christ.
I'm mid-40s, and to me, I feel like I'm seeing more things than I've seen before, but that could be because I'm young. but it feels like that at on one level, you're right, I meet colleagues, I meet folks that are seeking goodwill that do, in that sense, have that mind of Christ, regardless of the language they use for it, that are actually present. And then I also see this reversion of a different type of like stonewalling of like, that's not what is right. And this really, this deep resistance. And I'm curious, in the middle of that ends up being a whole lot of unspoken space. That's tension that involves a lot of pain and frankly kind of leads to some of the burnout. How do you see this notion of that universal presence and where it's headed and how that meets up with us today?
Boy, you're saying a lot there. Where do I dive in? I mean, it's good, but what you're saying reflects the culture wars that are tearing America apart today. You know, either the desire to stay in a strict, what is called order, or those who revel in disorder. Uh-huh. And you've been in the school, you know that I say we've got to have both. You've got to hold on to order. And that's what contemplative life gives you, a grounding, a foundation, a rock on which you can stand. But it's so solid a rock that allows you, surprise of surprises, to integrate disorder, to develop a critical mind toward things, to not idolize nation states or denominations or formulations. Mm. And the first 2,000 years, I'm afraid that's where most of Christianity was at. It was idolizing, if you don't mind me using that word, making an idol of things that were relative, worshiping the nation state that we belong to, worshiping the denomination as if any one denomination could ever carry the full glory that is Christ. And that's why we're learning now, I think, to be a lot more humble. You know, someone just sent me a book recently. I use the word mystery a lot, as you probably know. But they describe mystery as the awareness of ASM. And ASM is always something more. Always something more. I see that mind emerging, that we're learning to be a little less opinionated, to stop holding our formulations so tightly and our politics so tightly. I'm most of the country isn't there, obviously, but I'm seeing it emerging in people who are on the genuine spiritual journey. They know how to hold on to order. They know how to integrate disorder and not throwing out order. And that leads them to what I call reorder, or the risen life, the enlightened life, the saved, transformed life. That's the goal. I hope I somehow responded to what you were asking.
Yeah. To put a finer point, when you're saying that there is an openness to to pain and to awe, is that right?
Awe and surrender,
Awe and
yes.
surrender. Yeah. Sometimes that work, this kind of even resonates with some of Brené Brown's work around this vulnerability, right?
Oh, I would
It's kind of
think
like
so.
it's kind of a meme
Yes.
happening in consciousness. But in this political divisiveness, because we talk about this quite, just last week we were talking about this with a number of facilitators at the Hive, the struggle of being a like-minded group, that then, in a sense, the challenge it is to remain in relationship with those that have different politics, different faith
Yes.
framework, that sort of thing. But part of the challenge there is at that point of, is there a surrender in a relationship with somebody that I'm trying to differentiate myself from, or maybe I'm already kind of betraying the ego's involvement in this. I'm curious if you would say a little bit more about how does surrender play a role in that deeply divisive
Yes.
world?
So many of us, especially if we're concerned about growth and change and social justice, we get almost attached to our critiques. We see that the imperfection of everything. And that becomes its own kind of problem. I call it starting with no, starting with what's wrong. And that's not a good place to start. If you start with the negative, you never tend to get much beyond it. And that's the liability of a lot of the postmodern millennial, oh, my generation too, if I'd be honest, where we start with an argumentative voice, a dismissive voice. And that's what contemplation shows you very quickly is inadequate. It basically, because it's not love. It's not love of the moment, of the person. It's resistance to the moment. No is resistance to the formulation. I'm sure you've been in many groups where everybody is a policeman of words, where you didn't formulate that right. You offended me by using that word. That's a lot of our postmodern world where we're trapped in the second box of disorder. So contemplation teaches you, yes, to develop a critical mind. In fact, even more critical, but not negative critical, if you can feel the difference. There's a good critical mind that's positive and loving and helpful. There's a critical mind that just enjoys being critical. Just enjoys being dismissive. And until you see that in yourself, because it's in all of us, until you spot that, I don't think you're at the early stages of contemplation. Which is why a true contemplative can forgive their enemies, can be loving and patient and humble, because they've seen through all of their games that their mind plays, the power games to appear right in the conversation. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
To say that it, the beginning of the path is the willingness to get to the yes.
Yeah. I mean, even my wonderful years in Cincinnati, by the mid-80s, we had this wonderful community. We were rebuilding Winton Place and other parts of the city there. But we had, you know, wanted to be very egalitarian and flatlanders, as Ken Wilber would say. We wanted to make all decisions by consensus, wanted to agree upon what our membership requirements were. And we sort of discussed ourselves to death. Everything was endless processing, working for perfect consensus so everybody was heard, which I still agree with. Mm-hmm. But you've got to realize, as I'm sure you do, it tends to become self-defeating after a while. Mm-hmm. If you can't just trust some people who might have the gift of leadership or teaching or direction, whatever it might be. And unless that kind of humility emerges, what we've found, and I was with the Faith Table people here last week too, mm-hmm. along with the Red Letter Christians, but we all agreed that most of those early zealous spiritual communities, they discussed themselves to death, and people started leaving because they wanted to do something for the world instead of just endlessly take the temperature of community. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Makes a lot of sense, yeah.
You don't learn that till you're inside of it. We want to be egalitarian, but we don't want to waste time when some people have gifts for certain things. We call them charisms. And others don't. And to pretend everybody is equally gifted in every area is just not true. So
I'm curious, and maybe this will be kind of our last question as a turn as we sure. turn towards a practice together. So you've shared before that you're a Enneagram 1, which would have a lot of
yes, terrible
pull toward. Oh, no, please, but towards that perfection. I'm a 7, so I can access that.
Oh, I can hear the positivity in your voice.
Yeah, there we go. But the that process of risking imperfection sounds to me like that's a little bit of what you're describing as that journey from Winton Place and other things. I wonder if there's anything in the last recent season, the last year or two of some of the shifts in the work that you're doing where you're like, this is still difficult for me in the work. Where does, and how did you see contemplative practice playing a role in addressing that difficulty or not?
You know, because I am a idealist, zealot, perfectionist by nature, we ones can find a reason every day to be upset about something. So I had to learn this the hard way. All right. I just can't be happy. I can't be gracious. I can't be generous with the event or the person that's right in front of me. So for me, as an Enneagram 1, since you brought it up, mm-hmm. it's some contemplative practice is necessary for my sanity and my salvation. I automatically see how everything could be improved. Mm-hmm. And if I can't learn to let go of that, I'm sure I become obnoxious. Do you understand? Because and in my later years, I can see where now it's much easier for me to let go of my way of doing it or my formulation. Because over the years, I've seen how many times I was wrong. I wish I knew back when I was in Cincinnati what I think I'm beginning to know now, because those were certainly my idealistic years. Now, some good came from it, but I'm sure I could have been a lot more patient and humble with a lot of people who were all young people in those days and very zealous themselves.
Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. I just appreciate you opening your heart and opening us to
these
things you're learning and just the presence of that. Yeah. We're going to take a shift here in a second, take a break. And after that, I'm going to invite you to guide us in practice, because that's part of the gist of this podcast, is to get people practicing. So is there anything you'd want to say to set that up now before we take that break, what we'll be doing together?
You know, one of the clearest things that it's pretty hard for people to disagree with is to recognize that the mind wants to do one of two things. It wants to reprocess the past over and over again, or it wants to worry about the future over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so that's why almost all meditation, contemplative practice, is teaching you how to do what we don't know how to do, which is to be present. And present is not living in the past and not living in the future. So let me just offer that as a little introduction.
All right, terrific. Well, Father Richard Rohr, it's great speaking with you, and we'll be back in a moment. Hey there, you've been listening to From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. I'm your host, Troy Bronson, the founder and director of The Hive, a center for contemplation, art, and action. We're located in the Northside neighborhood of Cincinnati. And after nearly 2 years of over 3,000 tickets to classes and events sold, we're announcing a move to a membership-based registration. For $30 a month, a Hive member can attend unlimited classes and events. If you're interested in this for yourself or interested in sponsoring somebody else in the Cincinnati area to become a Hive member, you can find more details at cincyhive.org/membership. As we return to our conversation with Father Richard Rohr, I invite you to get into a meditative space, maybe slow down a little bit, notice how you're sitting, notice the temperature of the room around you, take a couple breaths, and lean in with us as we practice together. Well, this is From the Hive, and I'm your host, Troy Bronsink, and I'm back with Father Richard Rohr. It's been great to be with you, Richard.
It's very good to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm just going to invite you to guide us into practice now, and I'm going to push back and turn off my mic, and we'll go from there.
Okay. I'll talk a little bit, and then we'll just leave a few moments or even minutes of silence, and then I'll say a few more things. I hope that's helpful. It's all about presence. How can I be present? It's not about knowing in the rational, intellectual sense. We lost the ability to combine knowing with not knowing, and not even needing to know. That would be what we're aiming for here. To live without grabbing on to ideas as if they're ever a perfect formulation. I talked about ASM, always something more. When you can approach the day, the moment, the person, recognizing no matter what I say, no matter what I experience, there's ASM, always something more. Don't think you've ever, certainly with God, have ever exhausted the possibilities. If we could just approach each new person, each new event, each new idea with that humility, that whatever I'm paying attention to, there's always something more. And that's the key to contemplation. You leave the field of the moment open. You don't rush toward closure. You don't rush toward resolution. So let's just see if we can even do that for a few moments. You see, we think we are our thinking. But I want to say that who you really are is your presence to things. And when you're present, you will know what you need to know. So let's see if we can do that together. Now, I know when we try to live in the moment, it first of all feels empty or lonely, or I don't know how to do this. because the mind wants a job, it wants to feel important. As soon as a moment of silence is offered us, we grab on to something to feel, I guess, important. I don't know. Very often we grab onto something critical. I don't know why the mind is attracted to that either. But just a thought like, I don't like this, or I can't do this, or this is stupid. We all do that. So I just want to name it. And that's starting with no. It's starting with a problem. It's starting with the negative. So don't critique your inability. Don't praise yourself for your ability. Just it is what it is, what it is, what it is. So let's see if we can do that together. The moment is what it is. And once I can stop wrapping myself around it or defending myself against it, it will offer its gifts. And that's how we get to naked being. Not the what of a thing, but just the pure being of a thing, the pure gratuity of a person, an idea, a bush in front of us. So let's see if we can taste that for a few moments. Our English word person comes from the Latin and the Greek, meaning to sound through. So it becomes a personal universe when you're a contemplative, where everything is a sounding through. It's not a static, inert world, but you give things personhood. And I don't just mean human beings. That you give the entire universe voice and dignity. So let's enjoy that silence for for a few minutes. Those of us from faith backgrounds, perhaps we too quickly think that every voice we hear is the voice of God. It might be, and it very often is, but when we hear the voice of God too glibly, too easily, it gets all mixed up with the voices of our church, our country, our politics. So contemplation has to be a clearinghouse where we learn to sort of tell the difference. And you know, the easiest way to tell the difference when it's the voice of God and just the voice of our politics or our culture is the voice of God is always kind. It's always patient. It doesn't shame. It doesn't take offense. So listen for the voice that doesn't shame you, but sees what is deepest and best in you. That's your soul. And that's what God always loves and what God is always saying yes to. So sweet, so affirming, so expanding. See if you can allow such a voice for just a few moments. So out of this more spacious place, hopefully more gracious place, we dare to speak and you dare to listen.
Well, thank you, Richard. What a treat. Thanks for being present with us and for holding that space.
Well, thank you for inviting me. What a miracle, huh? Here I'm sitting in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and you're back where I lived many happy years in Cincinnati, and we're getting to reconnect thanks to the gift of technology.
I know.
Hallelujah.
Unbelievable. Well, thank you so much. We'll encourage folks to check out the show notes and see ways to connect with what Father Richard's doing and the Living School and things at the Center for Action and Contemplation. But thank you so much for your time, and I hope we get the chance to do this together again sometime.
You're most welcome. God bless you all. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. Well, hey there, I'm Troy Bronsink, and this has been From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Today we've been talking with Father Richard Rohr. You can check out the show notes for ways to connect to him, his latest books, as well as the work he does at the Center for Action and Contemplation. Be on the lookout next week for a pocket practice, a shorter version, and The Hive is brought to you by the miraculous work of producer Joey Taylor. Take a breath and enjoy the day.